Well, this is not a boat accident. It wasn't any propeller. It wasn't any coral reef. And it wasn't Jack the Ripper.
It was a shark.
Just when you thought it was safe to open your podcast app.
This shark, swallow you whole.
It's time for the 3 Men in a Retrospective's look at all 4 films contained in the Jaws franchise.
Oh, boys! I think he's come back for his noon feeding.
To help celebrate the original film's 50th anniversary, Garrett.
Maybe he's not in the dungeon. He's already eaten my plate.
Matt.
Polly sent me to find you to tell you that there's a bunch of Boy Scouts out in April Bay doing their mile swim for their merit badges.
And Adam.
Y'all know me. Know how I earn a living.
Have dared to swim the waters started by director Steven Spielberg way back in 1975.
Jesus H. Christ.
From the blockbuster original.
I got the creme de la creme.
All the way to the 1987 final film, Jaws the Revenge.
What are you, some kind of half-ass astronaut?
The guys will look at each film and determine if Jaws is indeed a one-movie franchise.
I want to be sure. You want to be sure. We all want to be sure, okay?
Smile, percolated media listeners.
Mr. Mayor, Chief, ladies and gentlemen.
The 3 Men in a Retrospective's look at Jaws begins now.
Hang on to your socks, lads.
Jaws, released June 20th, 1975. Budget on this ended up being $9 million. Box office on its initial run was about $130 million. Now it's $477.9 million after all the re-releases. And this is directed by... Oh, goddammit. Sorry, guys. I lost my notes. I
Even
you
Spielberg.
Don't know who directed this movie?
Oh, God, let me see. Yeah, of course, it's Steven Spielberg. Boys... 50 years later, here we are talking Jaws. Goudreau, that 5-0, that was your gumption to finally get this going with the three of us, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I'm sure you guys both remember standing there on opening day.
2 years before I was born. Don't start. Although I do have a movie-going story about this that we'll get to, because I actually called my mom and got a very nice recount of when her and my dad went. Jaws, Jesus Christ. Here's the thing. And Matt, we discussed this when we talked about The Exorcist. Is there really anything else that needs to be said about Jaws? And that's the main question we have when we do these classic type films. And the three of us have discussed, there are at least 3 feature-length documentaries about this. There are books out there about this movie. Everybody knows the shark's name was Bruce. Everyone knows the shark did not work. And everyone knows how Spielberg had to approach this in order to finish it. So... I am going to talk about behind-the-scenes stuff. And of course, it's going to come up because that's what we do on this podcast. But I'm telling everyone right now that there are plenty of documentaries that document this. We'll talk about casting and that kind of thing. But Matt, would you agree? I mean, what's been said about this has been said, hasn't it?
To a T. I mean, you could fill an orca-sized boat with the amount of books and physical media that this film has encompassed over... It's 50 years. And I always hate doing these shows, to your point. And we've done quite a few. We've done we're doing Jaws. We've done The Exorcist. We've done Alien. We've done...
Star Wars.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. The challenge is always, what can I pontificate that has not already been said by at least 10 other people? Now, having said that, I do think this is a... Get crucified for this. This is a watershed movie in so many ways. And we have to do this in order to talk about the sequels, which is how... That's my perspective whenever we do this, because we did Exorcist 2 and 3. And I that was the ultimate case of be careful what you wish for, because those last couple were brutal to set through, so much so we had to watch the same movie twice just with everything reworked. Thankfully, we don't have to do that for this, although there's only so much you can do with a killer shark. But even this series says, oh yeah, watch this.
It's pretty important to talk about this because this is the bridge between New Hollywood, which was big in the early 70s, to blockbuster Hollywood. People were not that excited within the industry of this movie because of that.
This is the most important, or one of the most important movies ever made. it is the true first blockbuster, and everything from how it was released, how it was marketed on television, to box office revenue. So it's a seminal piece of American cinema that bled into certainly international waters. And you can't, much like Star Wars, you can't overstate its importance. And you can't, if you pluck it out of the timeline, we'd be living in a very different world. Like, and we talked about Batman 89, that we live in the world that movie created. But even that, as much of a phenomenon as it was, is indebted to Jaws and everything that it encompassed.
And I think this is what you got about, I'd say, four movies and four filmmakers, and they all knew each other. We've discussed a few of them. And I think that's where you see the giant shift in Hollywood and filmmaking. And they were all young filmmakers, you know, too young, dumb, and full of stupidity to know better, you know. But this changed the seasons of when people went to the movies. So that's how important this was. And between this, Godfather, Star Wars, I mean, gigantic, gigantic shifts coming out of the 70s.
That's crazy that you mentioned that. I'm glad you did, because I did a ton of research for this. I watched every documentary done for this podcast. I read the Jaws log again, written by Carl Gottlieb, one of the screenwriters of this.
One of the co-stars,
absolutely.
He's credited.
One of my big feats when I over at the other place was actually getting to talk to that gentleman for an hour. And that was one of the greatest interviews I've ever done in my mind, because I was just so overwhelmed by the fact that I'm getting to talk to the writer of Jaws. It was amazing. But this movie did change how movies were released. It also changed when movies were released, because it's so hard to think about now. But the summer was looked at as the dumping month of movies back then, because guess what? Everybody was at the beach. Everybody was vacationing. Studios did not want to release movies in the summer. In fact, this movie was supposed to come out Christmas the previous year. But of course, as we know, it went way over schedule, way over budget. So the fact that this was released in summer is one of the biggest follies of it, that ended up being a tribute to the fact that it created the summer blockbuster. The fact that it was released in summer meant, oh my God, I'm coming out of this, I don't want to go to the beach. Just crazy stuff to think about.
I mean, it was a great... It certainly put money into the pockets of theater proprietors, because people didn't go to the beach, they wanted to go to the movies. But that distribution model really is one of the important legacies of Jaws, because there was a time where multiplexes were not a thing and movies were screened in very limited theaters. Think of like Gone with the Wind was kind of the Jaws of its day back then. But you only had one shot to go see it, basically, unless it came to your town. And then over time, you started to have films be made with more prints that got released into more markets. But if you lived in like scenic nowhere and you were fortunate enough to be within the vicinity of a theater, by that point, you would get a very beat up work print of a movie. Like, frames could be missing, the grain could be really bad. So thankfully, in a lot of ways, the fact that Jaws was as successful as it was led to wider distributions. It led to a bigger demand for screens. So I think the modern model of not just how studios release their movies, but the wide net that they branch out to stems from Jaws, because the demand was so there. It was the movie that everybody went to go see and told everyone to go see, right down to in your own house. They would play commercials.
Yes.
Talking about people's reactions to Jaws, and that would instill people to drive 2-3 hours to go see a movie. Like, it was a very different world, but it changed a lot. Like, you, much like the shark in the movie, you could not escape it.
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit about the making of, but before I get to that, it's important to talk about the casting of this, because this could have been a much different movie. Starting with Brody. Now, there aren't too many names that were going to be cast in the Roy Scheider role, but there's one worth mentioning. And it's a gentleman, guys, that we have spoken about before. We spoke about him last year. A guy by the name of Charlton Heston. Heston was looking to be that character. He had read the book. He wanted to be in this movie. Spielberg told him no because he thought it'd be too strong in this role. After this movie had come out, Charlton Heston did nothing but talk shit about Spielberg, saying that you would never work with him. And we saw how that turned out. But Matt, Charlton Heston, different movie, right?
Well, we'll never know. There is a part of me that would like to have seen it, but that ties into another way that this movie changed filmmaking. This was the first pissed off nature movie that did not treat itself like a B picture. I guess. Oh, well, it kind of did because the B stands for blockbuster. But all the creature features up to this point, the movies that influenced this type, Them, The Thing from Another World, The Blob, they were always cheesy B movies, very tongue-in-cheek. They were sort of the slasher films of their day, where there wasn't much in the way of substance beyond just cool creature design and having fun with that type of stuff. And Heston was part of a movie with Planet of the Apes that really turned that on its ear as well, because that movie was certainly far more elevated than those movies I talked about. But his performance in that, as we discussed last year, did kind of lean into some of the tendencies of those other movies. You have to wonder if that approach would have carried over here, and it would have, could have led to a different type of lead performance. So we'll never know, but I think that possibility was there.
Different movie, because I don't think Spielberg stays on this picture if Charlton Heston is on. I just don't see those two getting it, you know. No way. However, I don't like Heston for Brody. I do like him for Quint. I do think he could have been Quint, but I don't think he would have taken a second banana type of role, you know, where he wasn't the out and out star. But yeah, different kind of movie, but 70s Heston, I'd be interested to see what it would be.
All right, let's talk about Quint. Sterling Hayden is a name that came up, but he was in trouble with Uncle Sam due to tax evasion, and he could only be here for a certain amount of time, and then he would not have been able to finish. So he was off. Matt, you're bigger into older Hollywood. Sterling Hayden, I mean, that's still that bridge between new Hollywood, isn't it?
Still, but he was also part of that bridge with his role in The Godfather, is also a movie that really changed movies. But yeah, he was part of that old system. And I also think he would have been much more, I don't want to say imposing, because that's not the right word, but that guy was like 6'5", very commanding voice. I think his performance would have been very different than what we'd have gotten. I think he would have leaned much more into, the character's already pretty similar to Captain Ahab, but I think he would have played it like Gregory Peck did in the John Huston adaptation. I think that's kind of what you would have seen.
Another one for Quint was Oliver Reed. And I don't know about that one either.
I mean, he had the mustache for it. That's about it.
The most interesting bit of this trio in the casting department was Matt Hooper. Now, Matt Hooper eventually went to Carl Gottlieb's friend, Richard Dreyfuss. But before that, Spielberg really wanted John Voight for it. Different movie if he had gotten it. Dustin Hoffman was up for this role. Spielberg even interviewed Kevin Kline, a very young Kevin Kline, for the Matt Hooper role. Another name, Jeff Bridges, was interviewed for the role. Big set of names there. Matt, what do you think? Goddamn, it's hard to look at this movie with anyone other than Dreyfuss, but John Voight? Matt Hooper? What?
I could see it. I think of the three, that is the role that could be the most, if you were going to interchange it, I could see other takes giving similar performances. But I also, were they just watching Midnight Cowboy and said, let's get either one of them? Because the fact that they considered both Voight and Hoffman tells me they were just watching what was popular at the time. And I don't know why you would want either of them, not because they're not good actors, but that movie was tremendously controversial. I know it won Best Picture, but it was the only X-rated movie in the history of cinema to ever do that. Mm-hmm. And to this day, it's still kind of provocative when you watch it.
Provocative is a way to put it, for sure. All right. Well, we know about the making of this, but one thing that was weird about this was, okay, so the producers of this, Richard Zanuck and David Brown, they purchased the rights to this for about $175,000. And then eventually it was about $750,000 to do the movie rights. They said later, I don't know if these guys even read this book, because they said later, if we would have taken another pass at this book, we would have probably passed on the project. Guys, they were looking at, I could not believe when I heard this, they were looking at getting a quote-unquote shark trainer to come to try to train sharks to swim with these actors. These trainers would come in and they say, no, you can't do that, guys. You cannot do that. So Spielberg, of course, had to build that shark, and we all know the stories about it. It didn't work. They would put it in the water. It would sink. They would bring it in after a day of filming, and then the people in charge of the shark would be painting it immediately. They spend all night painting it, because when they tested it in fresh water, not salt water. So when they put it in salt water, that was when the mechanisms pretty much shut down. And the salt water, of course, was hell on the shark as well because of the paint. So they had to repaint it, do all of this. All of this, guys, in all honesty, this movie was projected at a 55-day shoot. ended up going 159 days. Over 100 days over the shooting schedule.
They tripled their scheduling. And the only compromise is that you were in a beautiful... If you're going to be stranded somewhere, that's not a bad place to be.
Well, yeah. Martha's Vineyard's not a bad place at all. But in all honesty, Spielberg should have been fired.
Stanley Kubrick goes, good job, kid. But I do think the reason that they kept him on... I mean, look, Universal wanted to make this film. And they had already fired a director. And a lot of people didn't want to touch it. So it was kind of like, hey, you know that kid who keeps hanging around the freaking lot and studio tour, which existed? It's kind of like the actors. They're like, who do we have in the TMZ that we can get on contract to do this thing? And once it starts, I mean, good money after bad, but you kind of got to go with the hand you're dealt. It is surprising that he wasn't. And maybe it's just because when you look at the actors involved, I got to think they talked to some other people and they went, fuck no, I'm not dealing with Robert Shaw. I'm not dealing with Dreyfuss. I'm not getting involved in this. I have a feeling by midway through, he was kept on out of necessity.
Well, in talking to Carl Gottlieb, it's real interesting. He said in that interview I did with him that Sid Sheinberg was a big mentor of Steven Spielberg. Sid Sheinberg was also the husband of Lorraine Gary, who plays Roy Scheider's wife in this. And there would be days where he would come out and visit with Zanuck and Brown. And Spielberg put Gottlieb in charge of all the numbers that were being tabulated to hide them. Because Gottlieb and Spielberg were both convinced if they had seen those numbers and what they were spending and what they were doing at Martha's Vineyard to shoot this thing, they would have been fired on the spot. And they would have said, you know what? We're just going to take it to the lot, bring Dick Richards back, who's the one they fired that you mentioned, Adam, and we'll just finish it then.
And that is one of the benefits of them being literally on the other side of the country.
Yeah.
At a time where you couldn't email somebody about what was going on. You couldn't just text and cell phone somebody. So being separated, not only on the other side of the country, but then a 12-mile boat ride out to the island probably helps serve him pretty well.
They were kind of just stuck with the hands they were dealt. Look, it's a miracle this thing even got made, let alone turned out the way it did. Because by all accounts, it's one of the greatest outlier productions, considering that the hell they went through. Nowadays, when you have shoots that are tumultuous and you don't have the excuse of, well, the effects aren't working well because you could basically do anything at the snap of your fingers. That doesn't happen nowadays.
Yeah. And I mean, in a different world, we would be talking about Ishtar or that original Dune right now.
Oh, God, I can't wait to talk about that original Dune. Oh, there are so many things to say about that. You know what? The shoot got over and the stories that came out of this, like there was a story I had read also. I think it was also in the Jaws log where George Lucas had come by the set for a visit and Spielberg was actually showing him Bruce the Shark and saying, OK, this is what it is. And he was fucking with the controls and Lucas put his head up in the mechanism and he got stuck and Spielberg couldn't figure out the controls to get his head out. There's so many funny stories like that. De Palma had come by. If you look at the poster of when they're out and the chick's all, hey, shark, when she's on the raft, that is actually De Palma's girlfriend at the time had modeled for that, which she didn't even know. So she was pissed when she saw it on the screen. Just so many funny stories like that. But they have just released a documentary called Jaws at 50, where they're basically summing up all the documentaries that they have made over the years. And Spielberg is in that. I'm shocked that he's in it. I didn't think he would want to talk about it anymore. But he does say, he gets emotional when he talks about this now. He says, that damn mechanical shark, I thought it was going to be the death of my career, but it gave us all careers. And he got emotional. Adam, that was pretty shocking, wasn't it? You watched that, right?
I did. And to your point, I think that's one of the things I liked about that documentary. And it's Jaws at 50. I think it's on Disney Plus, Hulu, Peak, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it's everywhere right now. And what I like about that one, because I've seen more Jaws documentaries than I have Jaws movies. But yeah, Spielberg is usually there in file footage, but he doesn't participate generally. And maybe that's due to people. He's got weird contracts at Universal. That's why he gets like a 5% gross of the theme parks every year. It's ridiculous. So maybe that's a reason. But I liked him being involved in this one because it was maybe it's a man that knows at the end of his career, just looking back. But I really appreciated the time that he took kind of reminisce and. Yeah, get emotional about what it was, what it meant then, and what it means now. It's a pretty damn good doc. It sums up everything else well and kind of takes the chum out.
Matt, did you watch it?
I have not yet watched it, but I'll certainly make the time to do so once I finish watching these sequels.
Yeah, and so after the shoot was over, one of the first things Spielberg did was he got rid of his waterbed, because he did have a waterbed, and being in that fucking bed would give him PTSD of being on those boats all over again. So he got rid of that. You know what? The thing comes out, is a big hit, and this is one of those cases, guys, that no matter what Spielberg has done throughout the course of his oncoming 50 years that he would be making films, this is one of those cases where one movie gives somebody a lifetime mulligan.
I don't want to say mulligan in the sense that I think it showed that he could make something out of nothing, which is the understatement of the century. But I think it also shows that sometimes there is such a thing as dumb luck. Like the fact that they went through all this hell, and it's sort of the opposite of Ed Wood, where Ed Wood made passionate movies, like he put his all into it, but he just didn't have the skill to make it work. But this is the opposite, where you had someone who had the skill, put all the work into something that they thought was going to be terrible and turned out to be successful, which is in another tandem with The Godfather. This is another case where they took a best-selling book that is, I will say, deeply flawed, having read it, and improved on it in a lot of ways. The Godfather, Clouseau co-wrote the screenplay, mm-hmm. but they improved on the book. Benchley gets a co-writer on this, but it's not a straight adaptation at all.
No.
They take some big liberties, big omissions, and almost all of them for the better.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Adam, have you read this book?
No, never have.
Okay, because I did read it. God, probably been about 10 years at this point, 10 or 15 years ago. My dad had the old copy that had the movie on the cover, and my mom kind of passed it down to me after my dad had passed, and I finally got to read it. You know what? I want to probably piss some people off right off the bat. It's a terrible book. It is not a good book. The story is there. Pretty much everything that happens on the boat is there for the most part, except for the ending, which we'll talk about. But a couple things about this. One, there's a mafia subplot. The reason why the mayor is keeping the beaches open is because the mafia is forcing him to. And the character that Carl Gottlieb plays in this, the character of Meadows, is uncovering the fact that the mafia is behind why the beaches are open.
Yeah, because in the book, the mayor is indebted to the mafia, and they basically have him by the balls and control all the real estate in Amity Island. So if home market values plummet, all that basically goes to shit. So that's the biggest subplot. There's plenty of others, but you read that and you're like, okay, that was a wise omission, because you already, oh my God, that's so dumb.
It's so dumb. And the only reason it's there is to capitalize on the success of The Godfather. I seriously believe that. The other
stuff. Well, it's also there for artificial tension, because you have, the book has to make an obvious villain, and they kind of do that with the mayor.
Yeah. The other subplot. That they are.
Jesus Christ. Can I say this one?
Yeah.
I know this one.
So Hooper fucks around with Brody's wife. That's the simple version. I guess it's been a long time since I've read it, but at one point she like dated his older brother.
Yep.
And they have like an affair, basically. And that happens before they get on the boat with with Quint. So the wife is also written to be just an unlikable shill in the book, where she talks about like, oh, marrying you cost me my affluent lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
She's tremendously unlikable. And it also makes Hooper come off as just a complete sleazebag. Like, he's a college yuppie in the book, like a smartass, and not in that like endearing type of way that's in the movie. It's one of those things where that was also a very wise omission.
So wise. You're taking a soap opera subplot. It's very steamy, too. I remember reading it. I was like, holy shit.
Oh, yeah, they go to a motel, and yes! Like, it's described in great detail.
Yes.
It's amazing, because it does seem apropos to the way that so many books were written at that time. Women on page, kind of like women on screen, even back then, were not exactly given quality roles, quality characterizations. I mean, shit, they barely are now today, 50 years later. So I'm not surprised, but God, that sounds horrible.
It's so bad. And the funny thing is, when they bought the rights to this, Peter Benchley was contractually obligated to write the first script of this. He ended up writing two or three drafts of it, and he included those two subplots. And then came Howard Sackler, who, he is a playwright, right, Matt? He did The Big White Hope? Great White Hope?
Great White Hope, yeah.
Great White Hope, yeah. He comes in, and he does a draft, turns it in, and this is when Spielberg calls Carl Gottlieb, and he sends him the script, and one big thing was written on it. I'll never forget this when he told me this. The big note he had on that script was, eviscerate this. like, just take it apart. And I'm glad they did. You include either of those things, it's a totally different movie and not a very watchable one. One more thing I want to talk about before we get to the film is the Oscar ceremony. So the next year, 1976, is when the Oscars are announced. And, you know, you get this kid, this 26-year-old kid, make this movie. It comes out. It's a huge hit. He gets a camera crew. They are at his house. He has Jaws gear on. He has Jaws stuff all over his house. He's got a huge party going on. And when they announce the directing nominations, guess what? He's not there. But it reads as a who's who, Matt.
Yeah, you have Forman, Altman, Fellini, Kubrick, LeMay.
Yeah, that's a who's who. Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, it's a snub, but you also have to answer part B of that question, who do you take out?
That's exactly it. And what he says in this clip, it's on YouTube. He's just like, I lost to Fellini. You just see this kid get humbled in the course of this. I mean, like I said, he was on top of the world and he did not get the directing nomination. It did get Best Picture nomination. But of course, that year, One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest was everything.
I love his answer to that, too. He's like, we're up for Best Picture and I lost to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I voted for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Well, it's also the whole thing. You could have made the joke of, like, I guess the movie directed itself. And I always, this is an Oscars thing. I think there should actually be more nominees for Best Direct. If you're going to expand the picture field, why not also expand the director field?
Yeah, I've always pushed for that as well.
Like, it makes no sense to me. Because honestly, I think there's more movies that are saved by great directors that I wouldn't necessarily nominate the movie for Best Picture, but I would nominate the director.
Yeah. Because producers love their trophies.
Yeah, and this thing did, you know, it won Best Score, which, no shit. It won, I think, Best Editing.
Yeah, Werner Fields won for editing.
Yeah, it won the other three that it was up. It won three of the four. Mm-hmm.
And there is a true snub that we'll talk about that was not nominated whatsoever. There's a big one that I think is a prime 50 years later.
I know exactly what you're talking about. All right. So we start off underwater as a John Williams score starts up. And do we have anything to say about this score? I mean, I think it's so-so, I guess. No, this is just a tremendous score. Famously, Spielberg was not a fan of it when he first heard it. He's like, that's it? You have those two notes and that's it? But you know what? That score ended up being his best friend because when the shark wasn't working, the score represented the shark.
I think everybody thinks of the Jaws score, that whole dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. And it is, but that is a minor part of the score overall. And I think Williams does a masterful job, which it's John Williams. So that's kind of saying he does his standard. But I think overall, the score in this is pretty stupendous because what he does in addition to those notes complements everything that goes on throughout the course of this film. Like that sets up everything that he does with it, the strings, the horns, and that. So those notes are there, but all that is kind of the interlude to the rest of the score he does, which I think it's overlooked because that everybody who touches a piano does that. But yeah. I think the rest of the score deserves the credit as well.
Yeah, remember the Oscar was for Best Original Score, not Best Original Theme. It's not just one, it's not just one piece. In the same way that John Williams' music is not just the Star Wars theme, it's everything else, all the other pieces he came up with. And this movie, I think the score should get a starring credit in a lot of ways because it has to do a lot of the heavy lifting because of the difficulties they had with the shark. I wonder if that thing worked to its fullest capacity, if they would have felt the need to make the score as much of a part of this movie as they did.
There are so many what ifs when it comes to this movie, because you're absolutely right. If that thing had worked and Spielberg was confident enough to show it on camera more than he does, there are complete scenes that would be added here that would complicate the suspense that he ended up building with the shark not working. So yeah, the score does do a lot of the heavy lifting, and it's, you know what? My mom says it. Where she still, to this day, every time she puts her toes in the water at the ocean, she still thinks of it. It's ingrained in your head because of this. And on that note, I did want to mention, so this week, before we recorded, I did call my mom and I asked her, I said, well, you and dad were married. They were married like a set of months before the movie had come out. And they had made this a full date. So they decided that they were going to go that day. They were in, I think she said Southern California. And they were going to see the movie and then eat. When they got to the theater, there were lines around the building. It was opening weekend. So they ended up buying tickets for the next showing and eating before. And What my mom said was she was so thankful she ended up eating before she saw the movie than after, because of a couple scenes we'll talk about throughout the course of this. But yeah, rowdy crowds. I mean, I could not imagine just the thought of seeing this on the big screen for the very first time, not knowing anything. My dad had read the book. He was familiar with it, but my mom was, she was terrified. And a lot of it is because of this theme. It ingrains in your head. And it's been parodied so much over the years, but it's still effective. And I hadn't seen this movie in, God, close to 5 years, but I've seen it quite a number of times over the years. And we'll talk about this scene here in a bit, but a lot of its effectiveness is because of what John Williams does. So we then cut to a scenario we'd be seeing a lot of in the next decade or so, that of a bunch of teens gathering and setting us up for a set of them to be killed, or in this case, one of them being killed. Guy makes eyes at girl, and we cut to them running on a beach, and we get him to say her name of Chrissy out loud, so we know her name. Very subtle and natural. The guy is just too drunk and he stumbles on the beach as she makes her way out in the ocean. And we even see her leg raise as she glides across. But this is when we see the view from underneath as the shark approaches, puts her head out with a smile, and is then dragged across the water. And if this looks painful for the actress, it was. Now, she passed away, this gal who played the swimmer. She passed away a couple years ago, but there were rumors out that they broke her ribs because they were on the beach. There were a set of cables attached to her, and they had her body, and there was one set of guys on the one side of the beach and another set of guys on the other side of the beach, and they were pulling her across the water. And there were rumors that they broke her ribs, and she had debunked that before she passed away. But I gotta tell you guys, no matter how many times I see this scene, it is terrifying. As she's screaming, praying to be let go, William Scores plays, and all the screaming cultivates in her being dragged under, and the water is once again calm and completely silent. I don't know, boys, it's been 50 years since this scene first hit screens, and to this day, I'd be hard-pressed to find a better death scene. A wonderful way to start this thing off. And if nothing else, when people left the theater, they were going to be thinking of this scene.
Well, I'll put in my two cents about the things that I don't think have been expressed all that often, because the piece speaks for itself. I mean, this scene is up there with, you know, speaking of Alien, like, this is as well known as the chest burster coming out of John Hurt. The things I like is that it also adds, because this movie made people terrified to go into the water, but it's two other phobias that it's touching on. It's the fear of being alone, because she's by herself. The other guy is on the beach. And I mean, she kind of had this coming, swimming that far out at night or early morning, whatever this is. And B, it's the fear of the unknown, which really ties into the lack of seeing the shark. We know it's a shark. The audience knows it's a shark. But part of the ocean is, oh yeah, sharks are scary enough. But think about all the stuff we have not yet discovered that is out there. I mean, I am not scared of sharks, but I am terrified of the ocean, as far as like you could not pay me to go with James Cameron for a myriad of reasons down into a submarine to like unfathomable depths, because who knows what kind of monsters are down there. It's their house. Like, mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, Bruce is just defending his territory. You know, the same way Jason tells kids, stay out of my camp, the shark's telling people, hey, stay out of my water. You don't start none, there won't be none.
But a couple of things on this that absolutely blow me away. One, you kind of recreate the cover of the book and the movie poster with this. Mm-hmm. The image that they used for the book, which was then used for that sold this movie as much as anything. And it's a brilliant piece of marketing. But to have this set up with the kids, it's amazing how much this is Friday the 13th for the first, mm-hmm. You know, 5 minutes of this. It really, really is. And I got to say, it was a joke when my kids were in like second grade and they could bring a PG movie to school and I wrote down Jaws. But this is a PG movie with full frontal nudity and death here at the beginning of this film. Yeah, don't swim this far out of the beach, kids. just don't. I mean, she's out there a big, big fucking way. But it is horrifying. It's terrifying. And not just the thrashing about, but that she still gives a performance. At one point, she like comes back up and she's like, I don't want to die. And that chilled me to the bone.
And like I said, she's praying too as she grabs on to that dolly out there. It is so terrifying. You barely know this chick, but you really feel for her because of the pain she's in. Mm. Like I said, I was away from this for so long. I was like, okay, would this still be effective for me? And it was. It grabs you and it doesn't let go. We then meet our main character, Chief Brody, and his wife, Ellen. Now, Ellen's played by Lorraine Gary in a very Nepo-inspired role, as I mentioned earlier. Here we have Roy Scheider coming straight off of The French Connection. He had heard Spielberg talking about it at a party, and he said that he would be good for this role. Spielberg was kind of hesitant to cast him, but Matt, you know what I thought of when I was watching this, given the fact that I watched The French Connection just a couple months ago? is I could see that character in French Connection going from that movie to this movie. It feels like the same character to me. What do you think of Roy Scheider here, Matt?
Well, there is, because this character is out of place. He's an outsider in this town, which is also a trope in and of itself. I mean, how many slasher movies and horror films focus on the drifter, you know, who goes into a town? But it's a good example of learning character through circumstance, not through dialogue. I like how he doesn't know which phone's ringing. Even the fact that the way the sun enters the room, they're not used to, because they recently moved here. You also don't know he's the chief of police until he gets in the car. So he certainly feels like that character, but he's also not giving the same performance. And I think, of course, the casting in this movie, I think I wouldn't change anything. But I also like that they're not front-loading you with a whole lot of... Like, this could have easily been... Because he's a cop, he very could have been the narrator of this.
I think he's a good presence. I think he gives a similar presence in a lot of his roles, though. But I think he's good. I mean, it's funny. My go-to Roy Scheider performance, don't at me, everybody, is a movie called Listen to Me, which is a debate movie.
God's sake.
With Jamie Gertz. But I think he does a good performance. I think this is where, though, some of the screenwriting, some of the editing isn't the best. Because here, I feel like he's having a dalliance with this woman. I don't get marriage at first, and then I get that later. I feel like they're playing it a little coy. Like, this first scene, I don't feel like they're a couple. Well, I feel like they know each other, and he's there for a booty call.
Well, a lot of it is because if you listen to Lorraine Gary in later interviews, she did say that her and Scheider did not get along on this set.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can feel that, too. I'm with you. Next week, there'll be a more established couple, and you could tell that there's a little bit of affection there. But you're absolutely right. Here, they feel cold to each other, and I don't think that's the performances or the directing. I just think it's the feelings of tension that are between the two actors.
Well, it could have also been lost in translation from there. Maybe they had knowledge of the book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to play that off as well. I think there's a lot of factors. But I also, it's also a Spielberg thing. Nobody in Spielberg's family movies or the families in Spielberg movies are 100% happy.
Shoot, this may be the only one where the mother and father are together.
I was going to say, you guys are all over Spielberg when it comes to broken families. Here, this family, I find this family to be very loving to each other.
Oh, yeah, no. I get that later. It's just here at the beginning, I think it's a weird setup is all. But then to Matt's point, I like that it's fed to you by show, don't tell as we get on. Like these next few minutes, we learn about Chief Brody as the audience does. And I think that's a good way to do it.
Well, they compensate because there's plenty of feedings throughout this movie.
The Brodies start talking island talk as Mike comes in saying that he was hit by a vampire. And Brody gets a call about a missing woman. Love how even his wife calls him Chief. I guess that goes to your coldness, Adam. That's a great point you make, because what wife calls her husband Chief?
And it was that scene specific. Okay, I think this is only the third time I've watched this movie from credit to credit. Total. And I'm in my mid-40s. I've seen, of course, bits and pieces of this movie umpteen times, but I've just never watched it. I don't think I watched it until I was in my late 20s. So a lot of this feels like first time for me still. So yeah, her calling him Chief and the boy coming over, I was like, she's a single mom here on the beat. It was just the feeling I got. And I think maybe that was a first go with this.
So Brody pulls out of his driveway and we're getting something Spielberg would be toying with ways of doing for the rest of his career. This little town feel. We have parades, avoiding people on the streets. Brody is talking to the guy from the night before, asking what happened to the girl, as they hear a whistle and see that her corpse has washed ashore and is crawling with bugs. What I love about this is they're talking about this girl who's missing. And when it comes to the fact that he's told that it's a shark attack, and he's even told, what are you going to do, arrest the shark? What's the police going to do with the shark?
It's amazing how times have changed that, you know, the boy that she was with the night before is like, I don't know, man, I was drunk and there's a dead body. And that's kind of the end of the investigation into him.
Yeah.
And she's pretty damn far from the water. These tides, she's well up on the sand dune. Mm-hmm.
Well, this movie has a very, I don't want to say dark sense of humor, but it's not afraid of being morbid at a lot of points and bordering on cynical. So I also love the shark is a picky eater. It doesn't just swallow her whole.
Yeah.
Pieces just happen to wind back up on the shore. But that is the point. Like, okay, what is a sheriff who likely only moved here because he thought there wouldn't be much action is going to do with a shark?
Well, if you read about shark, they don't hunt for people. They bite. And they bite to see how they taste. And most of the time, they don't like the taste of people, and they'll just let them go. So this is pretty accurate as to how sharks are. But when we see that girl in the beginning of this film, she is so struggling because she's pulled under. So I don't know if he spit out the rest of her or what, but he had all of her at one point.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the one, like, I guess, bit of accuracy this movie has about sharks, because this thing did for sharks what dogs did for cats. A shark couldn't get a job at a gas station after the hit piece this movie did on them.
Yeah, and Benchley had come out in the years after saying he regretted that fact. He was a big shark proprietor after this. He tried preserving them for the rest of his career after this book. Because after this book and movie had come out, you're right. I mean, there were hunts going on, like we'll see in this movie, where people were taking sharks out because they thought the sharks were killing machines going after people, and that's not them at all.
One of the things I learned, and I was fascinated, that Benchley and his wife were devastated by the public's reaction because so many people were out hunting sharks just for trophy and just because. And those of us that grew up in the 80s remember, like, all weekend, Saturday, Sunday, our fathers would watch these Jacques Cousteau style people in cages filming sharks underwater. And he and his wife had funded a lot of those TV shows just to try to get people back acquainted with sharks in a positive way. I never knew that. Blew my mind. And it's stunning that some people will actually try to do right when they're taken out of context in an evil way.
So back at his office, we have Brody's secretary. He's telling him about calls that she's been receiving about kids karate chopping picket fences. And you know what? What I like about this is probably the extent of what Brody thought he was going to be dealing with when he moved to this island. We have these kids chopping these picket fences. Yeah, that's about as much as you'll... No, you have a bigger problem on your hands. And then he gets a call and we see him type the cause of death being a shark attack. And Matt, this is show not tell, right?
Yes, and it also shows that this movie... has dated, I mean, the fact that this movie still holds up as well as it does 50 years later is really impressive. But anytime I see a typewriter movie, I laugh because all I think of is The Shining.
Yeah, me too.
And the sound of the keys typing, echoing throughout the hotel, that's always where my brain goes.
So Brody asks about where the beach clothes signs are as he walks the streets and starts getting bugged by everyone. Brody then picks up some supplies and asks his underling to make some closed beaches signs, and this is when we meet the mayor, played by Murray Hamilton. Now, Spielberg had seen Murray Hamilton in The Graduate, liked him in it. He was one of the first people cast. God, he plays a good sleazeball.
Mayor! He's so good as the mayor. He's almost understandable, as evil as it is. But I gotta say... that jacket, that suit jacket with the anchors on it, top notch. What this dude is dressed. I think I might have a regular polo shirt like that for my cruises. Yeah, he's a really good casting because he's just sleazebag enough, but he's not Snidely Whiplash. You know, he's understandable with what he's doing.
Well, he's very much Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor, where he comes off as a sleazy used car salesman that somehow got into power. But I'm glad they removed the mafia
me too.
Component. Completely.
Yeah.
Because he's also responsible. It's kind of a critique on capitalism infesting a small town where if the beaches don't stay open, you know, people lose their livelihoods. So we got to put money at the expense of people's lives, literally, which is something Spielberg's done in a couple of his movies. You know, he's critiqued big business before. But even this is, you know, a small tourist destination. But he also gets some of the best lines in the movie.
He does. So Brody gets on this boat and he's joined by the mayor, who is telling him to keep the beaches open because if people can't swim here, they'll go elsewhere. They question that Chrissy wasn't killed by a shark, and even the guy who told Martin that he thought it was a shark attack, he takes it back saying, "I thought it was at first, but I'm having second thoughts now."
I like that part of it because Brody didn't go off on his own and decide this. It was the medical examiner that said shark attack. And then the mayor is like, "No, it wasn't." "Okay, no, it wasn't." I mean, I don't want to timestamp this, but damn, those politics still hold up 50 years later.
Dude, you're not kidding. You
know? Holy shit. Oh, man. Reject what your eyes and ears have shown you, God. But yeah, I like that Brody did not go off half-cocked. He was following his job, and then when the Emmy turns around, it's the last we see of him, but those little inclusions fill this out a lot better than just mayor versus chief.
Well, speaking of inclusions, they also very subtly put in and make it clear he's terrified of the ocean.
Yes.
Yep.
Which is an important factor that plays into the third act.
We cut to the beach with a little fat shaming as we see this woman make her way in. But this this is a brilliant scene because Spielberg is not only outlining Brody's paranoia and him reacting to every noise emitting from the beach. We're also focused on the splashing. We're focused on the people approaching and distracting him, with even a reveal of where the name of Bryan Singer's production company came from. That's some bad hat, Harry. We don't know who is going to die, but we know that someone is going to die.
Well, it's also the thing of... there are so many things at the beach that can kill you before a shark ever has the opportunity to take you out. Drowning is still one of the most common causes of accidental death. You could do something as simple as, you know, tripping and falling and breaking your neck. So I like that they're also showing that he's an outsider, because a lot of the shots and the blocking, he's either the only person in frame or nobody is sitting really close to him. And they also show, one of the things this movie does really well is how it emphasizes scale at the beach. That's why there's so many lifeguards stationed, because you're kind of responsible for like one almost 360 lane, because your body and your brain can't comprehend. So I like how they're setting up that there's just so many things that are setting you on edge. It's almost like it's the aquatic equivalent of a Rube Goldberg machine, where you're just waiting for something to start a chain reaction.
This is shot, for all the talk about Spielberg and history and all, this thing is shot as good as it was then as something that he is shooting now. This thing is shot beautifully. The sense of scale, as Matt mentioned, is fantastic. The Hitchcock shot that we get here in a moment is really well done. But I love this because, yeah, this builds tension. And it's in the daytime. Everybody's laughing and joyous and splashing, and it's all that. We as the audience, we know someone's going to die here. And ratcheting up this tension, we can't enjoy watching the actors have fun because we just know someone's going to get it. This is a masterpiece.
This is also the precursor to Poltergeist, where it's that thing of taking something you associate with wholesomeness and inclusion, with putting ghosts in suburbia, putting a monster at the beach, which you associate with summer and vacation and family. It's that... you know, that contrast that makes it scarier. To your Hitchcock point, this is kind of we have land, sea, and air, because the birds took the air, this took the water.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. The book is kind of written like more of Hitchcock's The Birds, because that movie, you can call it sexist, I will flat out call it sexist.
It is.
The book kind of has that same ilk to it, which this movie does not, which I think also helps it feel more prestigious than just what this could have been.
So Ellen is trying to comfort Brody as we see Alex Kittner. He's paddling out in the water. The first sign of danger is that Pippet the dog. He can't be found, as we see only the stick that's been thrown into the water. And then we see the shark look at all the swimmers but focus solely on the raft from below. All right, so let's talk about this death. It was going to be highly more graphic, and for people who are curious, there are images floating out there of where this scene was going to be before Spielberg flat out omitted it. Have you guys seen these shots?
Yeah, where the shark is literally like full, pardon the pun, jaws about to swallow a
pole. Yes, it's terrifying.
And I'm like, okay, that's certainly scary, but at the same time, that hinders the big reveal at the third act with the chum. So I understand, you know, out of necessity, they couldn't do that. But this is also kind of scientifically accurate, because sharks, when they do attack surfers, they mistake them for seals,
mm-hmm.
which is why the boards are kind of a no-no. I just don't think the shark likes the color orange. It's like waving a red flag in front of a bull. When you put that raft, that thing's an eyesore. But it's also Spielberg back then had no problem offing kids.
All right, let's get there. So the scene itself, I love it. Reason being is Spielberg shoots it from the POV of the beach. And in this shot, we see a bubbling of water on the surface, a spurt of red, and flailing as fins roll around and pull them under, which is completely accurate to what sharks do, by the way. This is why I got so upset at Spielberg not wanting to make me feel the kids in Jurassic Park were in any danger of being killed. Because here, as a 26-year-old hungry director, he was able to shoot this kid, get pulled under the ocean water, and be terrified as to what was happening to him. Another
kid, to this day, Narragansett Beer, which is spotlighted in this movie, they do every year, since I live near the brewery, they will put out every year, they do a Jaws pack.
That's
where the 24 pack of beer is the poster, and there is at the brewery, the actor who played Kittner signed it as, yes, I did get eaten by the shark, and it's sitting on the bar top in like a closed case.
This is another spectacular death, cultivated by the fact that Brody is yelling for everyone to get out of the water. Everyone is paired up with their loved ones, except for Alex's mom, and the reason we feel for her is because she had the chance to go home earlier, but she told Alex only 10 more minutes. The Red Raft washes ashore, and we feel for that mom because of how subtly Spielberg introduced her earlier. Still a great scene, and yet another one where if this was all Jaws had, it would still be considered a classic. It's because this film is chock full of these scenes that it is considered a classic film that it is. And another thing Spielberg does so well here, and he does it throughout the movie, and I didn't really notice it until I watched it this time and watched it with a critical eye, is we have these scenes that are very frantic. William's score is echoing and people are yelling and screaming, but that quiet of that raft washing ashore and that mom looking at it. At one point, it has us getting our breath back, but in another, we're sighing because we feel for her. Just tremendous scene.
I go one way, then I go another, then I go back to it. I love all the setup going out to it. And I had forgotten who was going to get it. When Alex is out there and you're like, oh boy. But then the dog, and you're like, oh, that's right. They're going to actually do a dog, because you're not going to kill a kid. There's no way. And then when Alex gets taken under, it's horrifying. But I can't get on board with the freaking water fountain of blood spurting up from the ocean. I can't. It works, but it's so cartoony to me when that's just like a fire hydrant that gets turned on from underneath.
It looks like when Johnny Depp gets sucked in the bed in Nightmare on Elm Street.
But then at the mass chaos, and then that yellow raft, which Spielberg hits yellow a few times throughout his movies in his career, you know, and it's just it's almost like red that we get, and so, you know, just so I love it. And then his mother on the beach is just horrifying as a parent. As a parent who takes their kids to the beach and who knows that there's not sharks that close to the water because the shark would beach itself. Hang on, we'll save that for later. But the way this scene ends, and I love that Alex is played by a guy whose last name is Voorhees.
Yeah.
There is something beautiful about that. But this scene is so fucking horrific because this is a slasher death where then you get to watch the parent walk around realizing what just happened.
See, the reason why the red works for me is because we're seeing it from the POV of the beach. Did they see it or did they not? We even see a guy get up and say, did you see that? And what also sells it is the very next shot he has is of the kid being sucked under and drowning pretty much as he's being eaten. I mean, it's horrifying. And goddamn, this 26-year-old Spielberg, I wish he would have made Jurassic Park. That's all I got to say. We then cut to a town meeting where we're hearing that Mrs. Kittner has put up a $3,000 bounty for the one who kills the shark, and people are making cracks about whether the bounty is going to be in cash or check, and we're hearing from Brody that they are going to be closing the beaches, and the mayor adds, for only 24 hours. And this is when we are introduced to Quint, who offers to catch this bird for them for $10,000. We have this nails on the chalkboard. Great introduction. Matt, go ahead. How do you feel about Robert Shaw in this role, sir?
I mean, this is the... How is he not nominated for Best Supporting
Unbelievable.
Actor?
Unbelievable.
This is the definition of stealing a movie.
Yeah. Like,
it's not just this. He gets the monologue of all monologues, and they still didn't nominate him, and that wasn't even in the fucking book. They just insinuate that he was a Marine. It's like a theory. They never actually say it. And this, my God, is he great in this movie. Now he didn't make a ton of movies because he passed away. He was only like 50 when he died. But, you know, he did this. He did a Bond movie. Now, this will tie into Jaws 4. He did the original Taking a Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Yes.
But, man, like, he steals every scene he's in. But it works because you never feel like he's trying to do that. It's just a natural. My only question is, where did this guy come from? Does he just live here?
Yeah, I do feel like we almost need to see Quint have a cabin way out by himself. You know, kind of like just nobody goes to that crazy old man's place.
Well, we see
place
his house later.
Yeah, but I mean, we don't get a whole lot of the interaction from the community about him. But I do love what he's hearing. It's just like the 3,000's for me, you know, the 10,000's for the shock. He's great till he isn't in this movie, but I agree with Matt that Shaw wasn't nominated for supporting act is an absolute travesty. And it's got to be because he was an asshole. And you talked about some of the other people who couldn't be around because of tax issues. And Shaw had to go home to Canada every weekend so that he didn't spend a certain number of days in the United States because he was hiding from the United States tax man.
Shaw is such a fascinating... When you look at his life, the guy was married 3 times, had 10 kids.
Jesus.
One of them actually has a play out called The Shark Is Working, which from what I hear isn't very good, but he's out there trying, and he looks exactly like him too, if you look at that documentary.
Yeah, he does.
So Brody just looks at Quint with some fascination, and we're seeing signs put that the beaches are closed as Brody goes through some shark books that I'm sure I eventually had as a teenager. I mean, I was so taken by this movie.
It sets up the end of this movie, though. It's a little blink if you miss it, but in this book that it shows something, and I'm like, that, I don't know why it would be in the book other than to Easter egg the finale.
I mean, after this movie, believe it or not, this was not the one I watched the most as a kid. You guys are going to laugh because go back to our Superman retrospective. What one did I love the most as a kid? I didn't like the first one. I liked the third one.
Oh, boy.
And that was me with this series, too. I watched number three was the first one I ever saw, and it was the one I watched the most. But as a teenager, I was so taken by sharks that I wanted to be a marine biologist, and that was going to be my main goal. Just unbelievable just how much this movie piqued my interest in sharks. I had a ton of these books as well. So Ellen takes away the book, and she gives Brody some wine and asks if he wants to get drunk and fool around. We see that Mike is out on his boat, and the two get in an argument about whether or not Mike should be in this boat. Ellen eventually joins the side when she sees an image in a book of a shark hitting the side of a boat. And I love the look of surprise on Brody's face when this happens. He's like, oh, now you're mad. We then cut to two fishermen put out one of their wives' holiday roasts to try and what, lure the shark in so they can look at him? What was the plan here?
Yeah, they're fishing with his wife's holiday roast.
I love this next set of shots of Brody just thumbing through these shark books because we not only see the effects of shark attacks and what they can do, but as you mentioned, Adam, Spielberg also sets up how the shark eventually dies. As implausible as it is, I do love this fisherman attack going to this scene. Yes, it is done because the shark couldn't work and they had no choice, and they filtered the light to make sure it looked dark, but this dock turning around and heading to the guy as he tries pulling himself out of the water is just superb. Again, it's helped by William's score, and it is ended by a punchline with the guy saying, can we just go home now?
That's like how the shark is committing outright vandalism by trying to destroy the dock.
Yeah.
Yes, that it tears apart the dock and just to bring it back. And there's obviously, of course, a lot has been made about not seeing the shark. And we discussed other filmmakers who ape that same thing by not showing the monster until the end. It works so well in this movie because of the characters, because of how the story is being told. The monster is not being held just as a gimmick. It feels like part of the story. And that's why it works here and doesn't work in, oh, I don't know, Godzilla. It's scary the entire time you go through this film. The monster is just beneath the water that normally you'd be able to see.
So you see Brody head to where the fishermen are as Ben Gardner pulls up. And we see who we'll eventually know is Hooper, played by Richard Dreyfuss. Now, we talk a lot on this podcast about who the directors identify with the most when they make films. I seriously think that Hooper is kind of a stand-in for Spielberg here. How do we feel about Richard Dreyfuss?
Well, physically, there is a very strong resemblance right down to the glasses, the facial hair. I mean, facially, they even look pretty similar, so I can see, especially because he doesn't resemble the character in the book, or from a characterization standpoint. I think he's a lot of fun. You know, he's kind of the comic relief of the movie, but I also like that he's not incompetent. Like, this is the thing that I appreciate in certain movies where you have experts that actually feel like they're credible with what they do. But that doesn't mean that they aren't people too. And I think, Dreyfuss, I have a love-hate relationship with Richard Dreyfuss because I think he's a great actor. But there was a period where he just made a lot of movies I did not care for. And sort of knowing what we know now behind the scenes, he kind of comes off as like prestigious Chevy Chase. If you listen to certain people talk about working with him.
Not just till the end of how I was going to finish it, but I think Dreyfuss is amazing in this film. Like, he might be who I actually connect with the most out of our three main leads for, if you include the score. I think Dreyfuss is given a great performance. I think he's fun at the same time, serious when he needs to be, obviously gives the exposition, you know, to kind of break stuff down. And there's just something about bringing in just some nerdy guy from school. You know, who brings in a freaking biologist, you know, a marine biologist into your slasher film? It is a great way. I'm assuming he's in that's the same job in the book, but it's a nice way because you have three radically different characters that have to team up in this, and it's fantastic. But yeah, Dreyfuss, I think, is a major bright spot. Great casting of the ways they could have went. I don't know if you could have done better.
I love how Hooper just looks at this band of idiot fishermen, laughs, and just says, they're all gonna die. I also love how everyone is talking over the other. That's one thing Spielberg does in this, is there's a lot of overlapping dialogue in this. And it takes a very skilled filmmaker to be able to pull that off, because we've talked about movies where it doesn't work. Goonies.
But also it works, you know, it's the precursor to Alien.
Definitely, yeah. Hooper is now alone with Brody, and they introduce themselves to each other, and Hooper says that he needs to see the remains of Chrissy Hawkins to determine if it's a shark attack. We then cut to all the fishermen heading out to get the shark, including throwing dynamite in the water, which, okay.
See, this is one of the things that... is this supposed to be a commentary on, like, small-town, like, hillbilly culture?
Well, if $3,000 is on the line, I mean, you're going to go out and do whatever the fuck you can.
That's also true, but this feels like it's a bad, 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 bad world where people are just doing anything for money. But I also give it a little bit of a pass because we knew next to nothing about sharks. I mean, look at the response to this movie as Exhibit A, but I could see how this tracks because oceanography was not really a thing at this time as far as like creature study. So it's unfortunate what the shark population had to go through, but at least some positives have come out of it.
So Hooper observes the remains, again, a PG movie, guys, and he's having trouble keeping his cool as Brody tries lighting up, and Hooper's like, no smoking here, thank you. Love that moment.
Yeah, even though Man-Thing said, fuck that.
Hooper's taking in some water, and he lifts the arm out of the box. It's a powerful shot, and it is what makes Hooper determine that this wasn't a boating accident, it was a shark. The fact that this chick that we saw in the beginning of this movie is down to... being put in this box. It's another horrifying element of this movie that's subtle but there.
This is also how a lot of people respond when they see the aftermath of buffets. This was no boating accident.
It's the monologue that kicks this podcast off. I put it at the beginning. We then cut to a tiger shark getting hung and pulled open, and Brody is just ecstatic thinking they caught the shark, but it is Hooper who says that he doesn't think it's the same shark that killed the boy or Chrissy, so he wants to do an autopsy, and I love the mayor's response to this. He doesn't want to be around when that fish is cut open and the two bodies just spill out onto the dock. I love Hooper being told to move as he tries taking the bite radius of the shark, and everybody's trying to get each other's pictures. This is fun stuff.
It's also very coincidental that a tiger shark happens to be in the same water as a great white. Like you have another large man-eating shark, because a great white, that's already kind of an outlier, especially around here, like Martha's Vineyard, Cape Cod. But they double down by, oh yeah, we have a tiger shark, which predominantly live very far out in the ocean, come back to. But they got it right. You know, they are the garbage disposals of sharks. They'll just eat anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I learned when I was studying sharks was they do. They'll eat anything, including the license plates that we'll see later.
I love that. Yeah, this is when you play fast and loose with what sharks are in what areas. And as somebody who used to have a certification for diving and stuff, I love marine life. You just have to go along with it. But I do like the license plate reveal. And they use that to show how far he's traveled, you know. Yeah. Oh, he came up from such and such. How do you know that? Suddenly the license plate comes falling.
This is also when they are visited by Alex's mom, who wallops Brody and tells him that even though he knew there was a shark, he just let people go swimming, which is why Alex is now dead. I love this scene, not just because of the lore of how this woman apparently had no idea how to fake hit. But it also tells Brody that there is no choice in the matter. The reason he tells the mayor that she's not wrong is because he knows now that he must kill the shark and protect people from any further pain. Great scene here.
You can also tell that was an authentic slap based on the sound it makes. Like, you can't replicate that through post-production. Mm-hmm. If you did, it would have sounded like when Indiana Jones punches people.
Mm-hmm. What I love, too, is you got to realize this is a man who's scared to go in the water. And she lost her child in that water. Yep. That's fucked up.
Now, the scene of Brody and his kid, very, very sweet. I liked it as a kid. I laughed at the faces they made at one another and the way they crossed their fingers the same way. I love it even more as an adult because in a movie filled with darkness, it provides a bit of levity. Apparently, Scheider saw this kid just kind of doing these faces and imitating on the side. And he told Spielberg, we got to do something with this. And they included this scene. Sweet little scene. Adam, as somebody who has a son that's now a teenager, he must have probably done stuff like this when he was a kid, huh?
I absolutely did, still do, you know, when I catch it or when I see him do something that I'm like, I know where he got that. Same with my daughter, sadly enough. Oh, God, kids, don't grow up to be me. I love this scene as much as anything in the movie because it stops to take 90 seconds to humanize all of it. And it's fantastic. You know, you got other parents around here losing their kids. And suddenly this fear is about to be brought home here pretty damn soon. But this is to take a pause in a movie that might be pushing the length by the end of it, just to include this, I think is good because a lot of films would have cut it out, but it brings something to Brody. It brings something to the family.
They are now joined by Hooper, who, as we mentioned in the book by this time, was banging Brody's wife, but it's not happening here. And that makes this next scene even better as Martin opens the bottle and fills not a wine glass, but a drinking glass. It's level full with this wine. As Hooper's like, let that breathe. And he's like, nope, I'm going to fill this thing up. Hooper's telling stories about how his boat was eaten by a shark as a kid and that he thinks there's still a shark problem as they've caught a shark, not the shark. Which was a line I used to use a lot when I was a kid. I used to say that line a lot.
It's kind of needed because this movie is also trying to, instead of being a prototypical B movie, it's actually a drama. It's a drama with a shark in it, which I think also helps elevate it. Like they looked at this from a different perspective as far as how they were going to tell the story. And to do that, you need to actually spend some time with your principal characters. And that's kind of ballsy to do considering most of the third act is just three guys on a boat getting on each other's nerves.
But you're right. We need to know what they're chasing. So I like this scene for that reason as well.
Yeah, I do. I think it's a good setup as we start to really go into the second half that we get going.
Brody says that he hates the water because of drowning, which I thought was a great line. Ellen's like, what was it you said? Like, what? Why do you not like it? And Brody just says, drowning. And he's trying to verify some facts that he read about sharks. Again, I think this is great because it's giving the audience a feeling that they're in the know. Brody says that they need to have one more drink and then go cut the shark open. And when his wife asks, can you do that? He goes, I can do anything. I'm the chief of police. I love how Schneider plays this. We see Hooper once again show some ticks as he cuts the shark open, brings out some fish and a license plate, which says 007, by the way, because Spielberg was really vying to do a Bond movie around this time. And I remember reading about sharks and again reading what Hooper says here, that tiger sharks are like garbage cans. They'll eat anything.
Well, it's also that Bond reference is very, you know, self-reflective because the next one that came out had a character named Jaws in it and dealt with a guy who wants to turn the world into an ocean.
Right.
It's a good moment. I like the way it's shot too, you know, kind of from behind. He's just throwing parts out of the shark. The belly's considerably bigger than the size of the shark, but I love this. And it goes to the point that you don't know what these things are willing to consume.
That's the part that makes me laugh. This thing should look like Jabba the Hutt if there's that much stuff in it.
Hooper then says that he's going to be heading out in the water and he needs Brody to drive the boat drunk. They're drinking wine and eating pretzels as Hooper gets a feeling and decides to go in the water. So as he's going under, he pulls a tooth out. More suspense through the use of Williams' music is being done as Hooper gets another huge scare of this movie. As the head of the man who greeted him on shore, Ben Gardner, comes at him. And one thing I really like about Dreyfuss's performance in this movie is his acting from behind his mask. The screaming he does is both funny and terrifying. And we'll see that again later. But man, my mom said when this scene showed up, she jumped out of her seat. It terrified her. Filmed in editor Verna Field's swimming pool because Spielberg got greedy. He wanted to do another scare because of how the response was to how the shark shows up with Schrider later in the film. This is what he came up with, and he thought, I went a little too far because by the time that scene came up, this kind of took the steam out. But God, I love this scene.
It's one of the great jump scare, like, I don't want to call it forgotten jump scares because people certainly know about it. If you have any semblance of knowledge about horror movies and like big scary scenes, but it's also kind of a good jolt because the movie has been pretty calm and upbeat for the last 15 minutes. So I like this just hard cut to, again, you're seeing the aftermath of what the shark does before you see the actual shark.
Yeah, you know who didn't know about this jump scare? Me, who'd barely seen this movie.
Oh God, this got you, huh?
Oh my God, this got me, especially the way that the eye looked and the face. Oh, so well done. I'm gonna say though, I'm gonna agree with Spielberg because I love them and kind of the team building at night. I love them out on the boat. When it changes, and you can tell when it changes because it is lit differently, the colors are differently done. It's by the time Hooper is coming back up, you know they're not out at night somewhere doing this. And it takes me out of the film because I'm just like, why are he suddenly in like a pool of yellow water coming back up to the boat? All the tension is just kind of taken away because of how it was shot, you know, how it was ended. But I love this scene and just the anticipation of just, what do you mean you're going to go in the water? Get out of the water. Don't go in the water. You know, it's so damn good.
We see Hooper and Brody try convincing the mayor that the shark is still out there. Hooper dropping the tooth means that their evidence is gone and the mayor is not convinced and the economy comes first. And Matt says that, Hooper I mean, that he's going to continue ignoring the problem until it swims up and bites him in the ass. Wonderful line.
Love that line.
Vaughn wants Brody to instead concentrate on catching whoever was responsible for vandalizing the Amity sign as they will be open for the 4th of July and they need to do whatever they need to do to keep the beaches safe. great scene here. The mayor is not budging.
So well done. You know where his loyalties lie. And for somebody who hasn't read the book, I don't need a mafia subplot to understand. This does perfectly well in and of itself. And he's a villain without being villainous. And in today's day and age, if you think this wouldn't happen, look around you, everybody. So yeah
this you lived through COVID, everybody.
I was going to say, this is COVID all over again, man. I really got anxious watching this.
So yeah, I like this huge.
We cut to the 4th of July as so much chaos is being shown and the tourists are all over, bringing in that money that the mayor so craves. Love the Shark Attack arcade game. I wanted this as a kid. I wanted to play this. Apparently, while waiting on word on if the shark would work or not, Spielberg would spend hours playing this game. Another very good scene here is we're seeing Chum being thrown in the water and Benchley gets his cameo in as a reporter. Apparently, he chastised Spielberg so much about the ending that he came up with that Spielberg had him thrown off the set right after his cameo.
I'm going to say, though, seeing this massive ferry come out, it doesn't give the credit, but it completely just validated the massive amount of people. Because you think the beach was filled yesterday. This ferry is just... Mm-hmm. I have ferries over here that cross the bay taking people from Martinez to San Francisco and such. Like, this thing is fucking giant and packed with thousands of people. So it just a little moment to kind of show exactly what we were going to be in for.
I love Vaughn chastising this guy who works for him for not getting in the water. Even though Vaughn's in this fucking anchor jacket, he's not going in the water, but he wants this guy to. We're seeing people be kind of scared as others jump right in and helicopters are flying overhead and Hooper is on the lookout from a boat. We're even seeing Brody himself tell Mike, his son, to take his boat into the pond. Mike says that the pond is for old ladies and Brody responds, I know it's for the old ladies, but just do it for the old man. More splashing and even more POVs from underwater as shadows are being reported. Again, lots of good suspense here. We see Vaughn brag about the predator that they caught earlier and that people are having a wonderful time as amity means friendship.
I do, though. This is when, and this is the problem with me barely watching it when I'm younger and seeing it now, with that line of Coast Guard and everything that they have out there, I just find it hard to believe the shark's gonna go under them into such shallow area to get near the beach and such. This is when I'm like, I just start to have little problems with how the setup goes.
We then see a woman who would eventually be Charlie Brewster's mom in Fright Night, which... Yeah, that's quite a pull, isn't it? She's the one who is looking at the fin. She's the first one that spots it and scrambles to leave the water. But we know this isn't the real shark, though. Why? Because we don't have John Williams music here. So after everyone gets out, we see Hooper say that it was just a couple kids with a cardboard fin, and they get out to see a gun pointed right at them. And one of the kids says that the other talked him into it.
I had a big brother. Yes, yeah. He talked me into it.
Funny, 7 years later, there'd be a whole controversy about guns being removed from a movie.
Right.
Oh my God, you're right.
But it is a woman with a red bandana who notices the shark in the distance. And Brody makes a run for it because Mike is in the pond. We see a guy offer to help them as they're all knocked off their boats. And Spielberg does another brilliant shot as he shoots this guy getting chomped on from overhead. Terrifying shot. Again, he was going to push it and have this guy being dragged off while spitting blood, but he held off on that. Again, just a wonderful choice because this shot here and of the leg falling later is immediately after is just tremendous.
Yeah, I like the way that we've changed now how we're seeing the attack and how we're seeing the kills. I think that's important to just having some diversity in the way this film looks. But also the score is very low key. Mm-hmm. Like you get the first, we talked about the beginning of this, you get the first couple notes of dun 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 dun, but then it shifts into just a low key, terrifying buildup of just swell of horror as we know where the shark is going.
However, Mike is still there and he's just swimming in fright as the shark's around and ignores him. And he's then pulled onto shore. Good stuff. I just love that. This is Brody's kid who is in danger. So now he's really going to go after this shark. It's capped off with Brody looking out into the ocean, realizing it's time for a showdown with the shark in his own space. And this, boys, is when the movie turns. I was trying to think. All movies have three acts. But this feels a lot like a two-act movie to me. Because as soon as he looks out in this ocean, this is when the movie changes.
Well, I wouldn't say it's got three acts. But part of the structure is... It becomes a different, I don't want to say tone, that's not the right word, but the approach goes from defensive to offensive. Now they're like actively hunting the shark, but also it feels like more of a third act because of how much time it takes up. Usually you think of a third act as like, you know, 20 to 30 minutes at most. This is like 45.
Yeah, it. I mean, you could almost split this film in the middle the way that this thing goes. I'll say that it's a different film at the end, and it's a hell of a choice to go from what we've had to, okay, now you're literally going to finish the rest of this film with three guys on a boat.
You know, you could make an argument that the first half of this movie is a horror film.
Mm-hmm.
And the second half, I want to call it swashbuckling, pirate movie, adventure. It really does change. And as a kid, it really threw me off because I thought I was going to be spending a lot more time with these people and seeing them getting off one by one on the shore until somebody eventually shot it or something. But no, we're going to go out in the water with these three guys that we have met throughout the course of this movie. And it threw me off, but I didn't really realize the genius of it. And plus, of course, we're making allegories to Moby Dick here. In fact, Quint was going to be introduced watching Moby Dick in the movies, and Spielberg couldn't do it, not because he couldn't get the rights, because Gregory Peck said, it's not because I don't want you to have it, I just don't like my performance in Moby Dick. I'm glad
what I love about that is he was going to be like Max Cady, yeah, just laughing his ass, yeah, off in the back of a theater.
And of course you're going to think of that. They were trying to make those allegories, but I'm glad that the movie cuts off when it does and we go into this now, because as a kid, I'm not going to say I didn't like it, but it just threw me off. Because we're not going to see anybody else for the rest of this film as soon as we get through this hospital scene. We're mm-hmm. not going to go to the land anymore. We're not going to know what Mrs. Brody is doing. We're not going to know what the mayor is doing. We're not going to know any of it. We're just going to follow these three guys. This is when we see the mayor in the hospital as they're smoking in the hospital, which always throws me off when I see this. And he's forced to sign the check that will hire Quint to kill the shark. Nice little moment here, and Brody goes to Ellen and offers to bring Sean home. And she says, home? You mean home in New York? And he goes, nope, home here. So this is when we cut to Quint at his place asking for a case of apricot brandy, and they take a shot to swimming with bold-legged women. I've taken this shot many times. Now Quint wants to hunt for the shark by himself, but he has both Hooper and Brody to deal with. And famously, Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss did not get along on this set. Apparently Robert Shaw was drunk a lot of the times, and boy, can you tell.
You can, and I'm going to say, and I'm going to be the asshole, I think Shaw is amazing in this film, and I think his presence brings a lot to it. I also think that there's quite a few takes where he detracts from the film and obviously is not giving a best performance.
Due to his drinking, you think?
I think it would have to be, just because it seems like a different type of performance. There's times where he just feels like he's not all there.
Well, that's probably why he was snubbed, if you want to look at that. You know, he wasn't fully conscious or had all of his faculties, they might have held that against him. It's almost Brando-esque, with the ways you can clearly tell. But as far as they throw punches, because Dreyfuss, if you poked him, he would have fallen over if he got touched by Robert Shaw.
I mean, Robert Shaw was challenging him to push-up contest. He was challenging him to jump off the 75-foot mast that's on that boat right into the water. And Spielberg said, you better the fuck not do that. There was a lot of shit going on between these two. And eventually, Dreyfuss and Shaw did make amends. And they did agree to actually... Shaw was writing a play because he was a playwright at this time. And Dreyfuss did agree to be in it. And unfortunately, Shaw passed away 3-4 years after this, the age of 51. And Dreyfuss has actually made amends also with Shaw's son as well. Very emotional moments there when he mm-hmm. met his son. And the relationship between these two is just crazy. And started off at each other's throats, ended up being very amicable by the time Shaw passed away. So Ellen's saying goodbye to Martin, and she's hearing Quint talking about a 15-year-old virgin and making sure that they have their rubbers. Again, PG-rated movie. And then after this scene at the house, Spielberg does do this shot through the jaws of a shark as their boat sails right through it. Very Spielberg-esque. You could call it cheesy, but I love this. I've always wanted a painting of this shot. I love this shot so much. So we have Shaw with his hat just to the side as he sings to Hooper, and then we get some chum being thrown in the water as Brody just can't stand the smell of it. I love these shots of Brody just taking this handkerchief and just putting it over his fucking face because he cannot stand the smell of this. Very city boy-esque. We then see a scene Carl Gottlieb wrote right on the spot, that of Hooper and Quint squishing styrofoam cups and beer cans in front of each other. And then, of course, we're setting up the tanks. Because according to Hooper, if you mess with these tanks enough, they'll blow up. So, Adam, we're setting this up, right?
We sure are. I mean, yeah, a little on the nose, but I don't know if it would have been for back then. I mean, now we've just all seen it so much, you know, so back then, yeah, you got to understand it. And I don't know if most people would have even known that this is what would happen with these kind of tanks.
Yeah, it's much like sharks where we don't know what it is, but fuck it.
Yeah, right. Quint teaches Brody how to tie a knot, and this is when Quint decides to strap himself in, thinking he has a shark or something. Hooper's sniffing out that he doesn't think it's the shark, but we see Hooper making faces at Quint and mock him at the steering wheel. Another great scene there.
What I love about this is that Quint knows something's going on. He knows there's about to be a problem, and you see him slowly start picking this up, getting this ready, strap himself in, get the foot rest, you know, everything. He ain't saying shit to the other two people on the boat while he's
preparing himself. Well, he doesn't want the mayor.
Yeah, exactly.
he's like, you're only here because the mayor made me take you.
Yeah.
I love it.
Brody then starts throwing Chum overboard as Quint tells Hooper to stop playing with himself as he's playing solitaire. We then get, guys, is this the most famous scene of this movie? When Brody backs up slowly with cigarette in mouth, telling Quint that he's going to need a bigger boat when the shark appears. Oh my God, just out of nowhere. And one thing about this, I don't know where I read it. Maybe I heard it on a podcast in the lead up to this, but there's a sound effect of a bottle being opened, like a soda bottle being opened as the shark appears out of the water. I didn't really catch it until I watched it for this. And you can hear it if you pay attention. And it's very subtle, but it adds to the scene. I would not have picked up on that.
I thought it was the CO2 coming from the shark, from the mechanics. I would say it's the most famous line. Like, it could almost be the tagline if you're going to give it one. But it's also it's not just the fact that the shark shows up. It's the element of surprise. Like, because you're not expecting it there. And also, there's, whenever the shark's been there, you hear the score. Yes. There's no music to tease that. It just happens.
That's a really good point. To have it without the score is a really good fake out. It's obviously as iconic as it gets for, you know, a scene. It's the clip that everything shows. But I also think it's the reaction that he has, because he doesn't jump back and scream. He doesn't yell. But just that surprise, like, oh, shit, I think works in a different way. That the easy thing would have been to scream, yell, and fall overboard. But it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think this is a great scene as all of them get a look at how big this shark is. So I got to ask, we haven't really talked about it. We talked about the making, but we didn't really talk about how we feel the mechanical shark holds up. I find it interesting that Spielberg, when he was messing with CGI back when he fucked with E.T., he didn't do any CGI on the shark. He could have done it, but I'm glad he didn't. I think it still holds up pretty well.
I think it holds up for 90% of it. I think there's some parts where it's a little obviously mechanical shark, but I think when it's just below the surface of the water, it is so stunningly terrifying that I'm glad there hasn't been any changes to it. And even in its worst moments, it is better than almost any type of digital effect, especially that he's gone back and put in movies. So I'm glad we have still to this day what we have. I can't wait to watch this on the big screen. I'm still going to do that. Can't wait. Depending on when this drops, we've just done that. So I really want to see this still on the big screen.
I'm glad they didn't feel the need to do any sort of special edition treatment to this, because they had every opportunity to do it, given how many times they've released this on all the formats. And you know good and goddamn well George Lucas is sitting on Spielberg's left like the proverbial devil going, you know, computers can really make that shark look a lot more realistic.
There's only one instance where it kind of takes me out, and I'll mention it when we get there, but I'm with you guys. I think 90 to 95% it holds up okay. So they start chasing the shark as Brody, the city boy that he is, just isn't fitting well with these two. Quint tells Ellen Brody that they'll be home soon as he comes out of the hole with gun in tow. Hooper grabs a tracker as Quint screams at Hooper to tie the barrel on. Great scene capped off with Williams' tremendous music, as now we're in a pirate movie.
We are. We got Captain Ahab and his two people out here for the white whale. And just that little scene of Quint and his two people hunting his white whale. But just that scene of him answering the phone and giving the answers and not telling Brody that his wife called.
Yeah.
If you don't think about it, like, that's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, what a dick.
Like, she's like, hey, y'all coming home from, nah, we're out fishing. He's about to land a, you know, what fish. But this is, a different movie than what we got the first. This is a different type of pacing. It's a different type of, I don't want to say acting, but the camaraderie here is way different than the other stuff. But it is great.
So they get the barrel on and the shark leads them even further out. Great shot of Quint on the bow. I love this shot of him on this bow. Another one I would just take as a painting.
Yeah, this action adventure type shit where they're out here. I love that it's during the daytime because I assumed we were going to be at dusk and night. So I like that I could see everything that's going on here.
Well, our next scene is that night. We get another just famous scene from this movie. These three guys, they start telling war stories about how they got their scars. And we talked in the Lethal Weapon 3 show that they pretty much took that scene from this. And I love how Brody just has none of these to speak of. He has this like appendicitis scar, but that's about it. But when he asked Quint how he got one scar, he gives the famous Indianapolis speech. Okay, a few things here. Before I get to the making of it, I want to mention one thing Spielberg has been doing such a good job of is balancing the fun with the horror. You know, as soon as you're comfortable seeing these guys enjoy themselves and laughing, he gives us the Quint speech, which is so well known. All right, so this originally wasn't in the script, but it was Howard Sackler, guy who me and Matt mentioned. He wrote The Great White Hope. He brought the story of the Indianapolis to Spielberg's attention. Spielberg loved the idea, so he had Sackler write the first version of this speech. Spielberg then took it to his friends, notably George Lucas and John Milius, who had some cracks at it themselves. But when Shaw got the pages to read, he, being the playwright himself, said that he needed to work on it to get it to his speed. The next night, he showed up with pages in hand. Spielberg said, go ahead and do it as you have it. But, of course, he was drunk off his ass, and he gave the speech, kind of slurring his words. He then called Spielberg that night, apologizing, saying he could do it better the next day because he's going to do it sober this time. What we really didn't know until recently is that the scene that we see is actually both takes he did edited together. And thanks to the brilliant work done by Werner Fields, as we've mentioned, you can't really tell which is which. But according to Carl Gottlieb, if you watch it in high definition, you can tell which is which because in the take that Shaw was drunk, it's wet under his eyes. And when he's sober, it's not. This speech is so great because in the book, Quint has no real beef with the shark. We have no real reason why he's going after it. He doesn't care who it's killed. He just wants the money. By making him be a part of World War II's most harrowing secrets, you have given Quint a reason to make this battle very personal. He doesn't want to kill the shark. He needs to kill the shark. And by giving it that depth, you have a layered character being performed by a layered actor. And man, is this great.
Well, this is his Ahab moment to bring that full circle because he doesn't have that layer until this speech. And again, I think it's a vast improvement over any of the writing that's in the book. Yeah. I think this is better than anything that Benchley could write. It's also a good example of like using unsung parts of history, so unsung that the characters, you wouldn't expect him to be a Marine or been on the Indianapolis. But I also like that it's the characters don't interrupt him, but he pauses a couple times. Now, part of that might have been because he was trying to remember his lines after a few too many, but I like that it's almost entirely uninterrupted outside of himself. And he ends it on as much of a lighter note as you could have, where he's like, oh yeah, we delivered the bomb.
Yeah. And to your point, Matt, how the fuck did he not get an Oscar nomination just for this speech alone? Just insane.
Funny, because as much as nobody could ever tell that this was different takes, one of my notes is, how come some of these cuts he's very glassy-faced? Oh, so funny. I guess I got my answer. For all the hoopla, for all the, oh my god, one of the best monologues in history, one of the best acted scenes in history, it's good. I can't say this is great. And I think part of it is because his tone never gets to a point where I feel, I don't think he's given me enough, like it is eerie in a way of somebody retelling something, but I don't think he does enough of that thousand-yard stare or moment that just makes you feel with him. What I get more from watching his co-stars kind of react than I get from him. It's a very good scene. I can't say it's great, and for all the talk about that Indianapolis speech, I don't think it's one of the great monologues.
Here's what I'll say to that. I know exactly why you feel so indifferent to it. It's because of how you feel about Quint. You're indifferent to Quint. The fact that me and Matt are really big fans of the character, we really dig this speech, but you are indifferent, meaning it's just okay to you. The way you feel about the scene depends on how you feel about Quint.
You know what? You may be, because I will say, I think if you flipped the scar scene and you had that after, I think I might look at it a little bit different. But you just broke the tension of these three with Hooper and Quint having this moment of bonding. And I think that is fantastic. I mean, it's great that Spielberg can go back in time and copy what I saw in Chasing Amy, you know.
God.
Fuck you too. But I love that scene so much that I almost wish there was a little distance between the two.
After this, they don't have much time to wallow because the shark is after them again. They see that he ate the light. As Hooper says, so Quint has taken his gun out to fire a few shots as Martin loads his gun, and a shooting star shoots across the screen, which was done in post, by the way.
After denying it for 30 years.
When I saw this as a kid, I took that as E.T. landing.
Oh, Jesus. No, that would be his next film. That was the Close Encounters come to visit.
Close Encounters, yeah. We cut to the next morning. The boat's starting to get in shambles as the barrel pops up. Hooper says that he has things on board that'll kill the shark, and the shark pops up again to make them drop the line. I love this. The shark is out there just kind of saying hi. It's like daring them to go after him.
I like this. This is why I like the setup with the barrels.
Yeah.
Because think about that. Bruce doesn't work, but we get a reference for where he is by having this floating barrel on top. But I also find it really convenient that Bruce decided he wasn't going to attack overnight. He let the guys have sleep before he went back to work.
He also made sure they were hungover.
Yeah. He has a plan of attack. We didn't get the Steven Spielberg cameo as Brody goes to the radio for help, and it's Spielberg who's responding to him. But Quint puts a stop to that real quick by bashing the radio, which angers Brody. So, Matt, I got to go to you. This is pretty much Ahab versus Moby Dick, right?
Oh, yeah. Now it's just like vendetta option A. Or you can infer he's absolutely gone crazy by smashing the communication. Cabin fever almost.
And I love Quint's response to this. He's just like, yeah, yeah, yeah. As Brody's yelling. Again, dialogue overlapping.
And that's what I love about both parts of it. And that's what I get out of the Indianapolis scene, and the part of it that I do like is that establishes that this is Moby Dick for him. That establishes he is Captain Ahab at that moment. And I like that parallel when I see him out on the jetty, you know, sticking out in the front of the boat with his gun. Like, that's what I get. It's that shot of Captain Ahab with the spear, you know, on the front of his. So I like the way that it's poised and the way that it's given us that same just mirror of characters we know.
So Hooper says that the shark has come back for his noon feeding as Quint fires another barrel into him. And this is the shark just leading them further and further into the ocean. Brody himself fires a few rounds as he takes down two barrels and they pop up. And at this point, Adam, he's just fucking with them, right?
He's playing with his food. Yes. This is Jason popping in and out from behind a tree.
Good call.
Well, it's also the inverse of the book, where in the book they try to lure the shark into shallower water.
Well, that's what Quint does here in a second, but
yeah.
Brody suggests leading the shark to shore instead of him leading them into the sea.
I got a huge, huge problem with this. This literally ripped me right out of it. Why are you going to lead him to shore where that's where he's been doing his killing? I don't know. For some reason, I'm like, oh, you take that out. You know, we need to get him somewhere we can get him. That's different. But saying you're going to take him to shore, you got bodies up on shore. Little thing, but I just couldn't get over it.
Well, at this point, maybe they finally convinced the mayor to close the fucking beaches. Because as the mayor said, his kid was on that beach too. So
yeah, but Quint, I don't know. To me, Quint should be smarter than that.
The shark is pulling them further into the sea as he again pops up, showing he's eating his way through the line and it's pulling the boat backwards, making water just throw itself into them. And you know what? I got to think about the making of this. I could not imagine being on this boat for as long as these three were. And Spielberg did say later that he did kind of regret not doing more of this on the lot and in the tank that they had, because when they're out in this water, there are boats being seen, and he had to cut around that. Not to mention, some shots their clouds are there, some shots they're not. Shooting out in this ocean, and Kevin Costner learned this lesson too in 94 when he did Waterworld, it's not always the best idea.
And James Cameron's like, you pussy.
Yeah, right.
While Christopher Nolan's like, I'm filming the fucking Odyssey in Universal's backlot.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not doing that shit.
But watching the shark tow the boat is such it crosses that action horror line in just the right way that I am like edge of my seat. Put that on the tag. You're going to pay for the whole seat. You only need the edge of it. That was me when the sharks just starts fucking with them.
Brody comes within inches of having his head taken off by a barrel, and the barrels pop up yet again. He then takes the three barrels under the boat, and Quint just has to admit that he's never seen one do this before as the shark emerges unscathed. Quint then says that he's going to draw the shark into shallow water and drown him. Even Hooper is in disbelief and short on temper as he just doesn't even let Brody finish asking him if a shark has ever done this before, barking out, "No!" And Quint's gone crazy as he just keeps driving the boat and it keeps overheating. We didn't see Hooper suggest maybe they can get the cage up as Quint is finally asking what Hooper can do with his little instruments and admitting that he was wrong. So we then get the suit up scene, right, Adam? As we get this cage up and going.
Which is, again, shark takes a break for them to get this
going. Hooper is putting his poison spear together, so they lower him down. What I love about this is when Brody takes his glasses, Hooper tries spitting on the goggles, and he says, "I don't have any spit." That means he is scared shitless. So mm-hmm. subtle.
And that is how you keep your goggles from getting fogged up for those that dive.
So they lower him down. And again, what a set of scenes these are. They actually got a little guy in a cage. So they had a real 14-foot shark. They got it looked bigger next to this guy. And this whole shot of it struggling to swim while on top of the cage is just fucking phenomenal. And it's the only reason why Hooper was allowed to live to the end of this movie. Because in the book, Hooper died.
Yes, he does.
He was going to die here, too. But Spielberg...
Which again, Spielberg, between this and Jurassic Park, he likes keeping characters alive that die in the book.
Well, no, he was going to kill him. The only reason he kept him alive was because of this phenomenal shot of this shark struggling on top of this cage that they got this crew who does undersea diving and shots underwater to shoot. This is a real shark. This is not Bruce up here. And Spielberg loved that shot so much, that's the only reason Hooper's allowed to live here.
Myself not knowing much other than clips and stuff like that, I couldn't believe they killed Hooper right here. I thought he died. I didn't realize he came back. I was like, oh my God, this is just going to be... And one quick moment from before, and I think it's might be one of my favorite bits of Spielberg, when you see Bruce racing back towards the boat with those containers on top of the water. Those look like torpedoes heading towards a boat. And being done not long after that speech, talking about, we got hit by two Japanese torpedoes from a submarine. It's just, to me, it was echoing what he had talked about earlier, and it couldn't have been a coincidence.
That's a good catch. I did not catch that. Of course, Spielberg's going to play with this World War II imagery a lot in his career.
1941.
Yeah. More great Dreyfus screams here. And like the tooth from earlier... Hooper drops his spear.
It's funny, that's how he reacts when you tell him there's more than two genders.
They pull the cage up, and man, is it thrashed. We then see the shark come up again. This time Spielberg has the shot to the inside of its mouth, and this is when I think it looks the worst. Nothing about how the shark is attacking looks natural. You could just see the hydraulics moving on the inside of its mouth as well when it comes up towards the camera. As I mentioned, I'm glad there's been no work to clean this up. This is 70s filmmaking, and Spielberg was going to get this thing made, whether it killed him or not. But this is the shot where I think it kind of takes me out a little bit.
Yeah,
well, you can tell it has a very limited range of motion.
Yeah,
that's the big calling card, but I'm not going to complain about it too much.
No.
This is when I get hurt by riding the tram tour, the backstage lot tour on Universal more times than I've seen Jaws. Because I've seen the shark there that looks better today than it does here. But I don't care. This is still quaint for Quint. I don't hate it because it's such a moment in time that does it look bad? No, it just doesn't look good. But I absolutely appreciate what it is.
So this is also when we see Quint just get eaten again. PG movie. We're seeing him just bleed from his mouth, scream in mortal pain. And this is the end, right? I mean, this is the cultivation of Quint surviving the Indianapolis, coming face to face with those things that took out that Indianapolis crew. And he is going to lose. And I love that it's the tank that hurts his hand that is what makes him lose his grip. Just again, like the girl from earlier, terrifying death scene.
It's also the most shocking, I guess, act, because like the blood capsule that shoots out of his mouth,
yes,
that he probably bit down on to get that shot, and just seeing his lifeless body get dragged into the water, I think this is shot really well.
I think it's shot well. I think it's still pretty terrifying. And I think you had to do this because just like Moby Dick, Ahab gets killed. And here, once again, Ahab is going to lose to his white whale. I think it's needed. And this is why I do like the Indianapolis scene, because it's the end that he didn't get then, he's going to get now. Final Destination caught up with him.
Spoiler alert for Moby Dick. So the shark comes back onto the sinking boat, this time to get eye to eye with Brody. I love the human tissue just hanging from the shark's teeth here. Brody goes into self-defense mode and throws an oxygen tank right into its mouth, and then climbs the crow's nest of the boat, assumes the position, prepares to make the hardest shot known to man. This is what Benchley rebelled against. He hated the fact that Spielberg made this ending. But you know what Spielberg's defense was? And I think it's a great defense. If I have them for 2 hours, they won't care. And you know what? He does. He has me for 2 hours. I am not caring about how improbable this shot is.
You know what is impressive is the shooting that Spielberg does from behind, that as the orca is going down, that you have the mast and you have Brody on it sideways, and it's just you're watching the boat sink, and the camera stays on it as he steadies, mm-hmm. and the sun's in the background. And that is such a wonderful, he's known for so many great shots, and I think that one is overlooked. It is tremendous.
I am right with Brody as he's aiming and asking the shark to show the tank. And you know what also helps? William's score. All of it combined with the massive explosion and exclamation from Brody that he did it. This was the final shot of the actual shoot itself. And you know what? Spielberg wasn't there for it. He heard that he was going to get pranked by the crew. So he jumped ship, so to speak. And he let his second unit take care of this explosion. And you know what? It's glorious. You know what else I love about it? The fact that this movie took so long to do and there was so much trouble getting this thing made. I feel the catharsis associated with it, where the crew is blowing this shark up, a lot like the crew in Gremlins 2 did to Gizmo, where they hung it up and threw darts at it for 5 minutes. This is the crew saying, we never have to work with you again. Loved it.
Yeah, it's almost cathartic watching it explode. That's why Brody's so happy.
It, would a shark explode like it was packed with C4? I don't care. It's a relief for Brody. It's a relief for the audience. God knows it's a relief from Spielberg flying home to Los Angeles at that time. Yeah. This is such a way to cap this kind of film.
Also in post, Spielberg added a little sound effect that he took from Duel, as when the truck fell in that film, he had a monster dying type sound effect. If you listen while the shark's falling from the explosion, you can hear that exact same sound effect. Just a little touch that he added that I've known for years and years before I watched the documentary. After all this, Hooper shows back up and Brody informs him that Quint didn't make it. They get on their paddles and head to shore as credits roll on Jaws, boys.
Well, it's also, I like that the you see them still paddling as the credits are rolling, but the full circular motion of, I used to hate the water. Yeah. I can't imagine why.
Yeah. All right, guys, that is pre-edit. That is almost 2.5 hours of talking about Jaws. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Jaws? Adam, as somebody who has watched this only a small number of times, what do you give this movie, sir?
It's hard to go back later and critique a film, judge a film that you know in pop culture and you know for references more than you know for the film itself. However, for people that haven't sat and watched Jaws in its entirety just as a film, please do so. Whether you're going to watch it at home, if you have a chance to catch the 50th re-release in theaters, or sure they release it every more frequently as well, go see Jaws. Go see it in a theater. Bring your family. I don't care how old or young they are. Go see Jaws. It is astounding that this film got made. It's astounding that a young filmmaker continued to make films after the difficulty that he had in this one. And I think when he's gone, I think part of Steven Spielberg's legacy is going to be how insistent he can be that he completes a project. Because he had no reason to stay on this, to finish it, and to make it as good as this is, as great as this is. And this is a great film. The writing is pretty damn astounding. The acting is great. Roy Schneider, he's not that actor you credit. He's great in this. Dreyfuss and Shaw together, they're money, baby. Their dislike of each other is so palpable that it works for this. But even other actors, Lorraine Gary is fantastic and soothing where she needs to be. Alex's mother, Mrs. Kittner, she's great and brings that heart and just believability to this. For a book that, from what I've heard from you two and from others, is okay at best, the screenwriting on this does a wonderful job of giving us one of the ultimate summer movies. Steven Spielberg directs one of the ultimate summer movies. Universal produced one of the ultimate summer movies, and the acting on this does it. I love Bruce. I love the movie. This is one that I think needs to be in a more regular rotation for me. I'm glad we did it for this. I believe this is the only one that Spielberg did. I can't say this is a Jurassic Park moment because I don't think he comes back for Jaws 2 Lost World, but we'll see. But this is good. And for somebody who has given Spielberg a lot of crap over the years, mainly because my best friend loves him so much, so I got to be that asshole contrarian. I love this Spielberg. And I'm really glad I got a chance to sit and watch this and discuss it. This is a 9 on 10. It is great, and I can't wait to watch it again next summer.
9 on 10. Wow. Matt, go ahead, sir.
Well, this is the part of this type of show where I say everything that's, as far as praise that is put upon this movie, is completely deserved. It's very rare that I'm that guy who looks at a classic movie and says, I don't think it's all that good, or what it's hyped up to be. When we actually do those shows, oh, trust me, I'll make my points well known. But between this, The Exorcist, Raiders, Star Wars, I can't be that guy. Like, it is, it's an important movie, and I've seen it probably somewhere in the intermediate between how many times Adam has seen it and how many times Garrett has seen it. Probably close to 10 in my lifetime. And I like that every time I watch it from, you know, pillar to post, I find a little detail or piece that I never picked up before. And I think that's really the legacy of a great movie. You can have stuff that's tremendous that I will only watch once for various reasons. This is one that it's not that I don't rewatch it out of dislike, far from it. It's more of the big picture. Well, what else can I say about this? It's a movie about a shark and everyone talks about it. But thanks to doing this, I found a couple things on this rewatch that I hadn't noticed before. 50 years later, I mean, it still holds up as well as you would think. And in fact, I think it's aged a lot better than some of Spielberg's movies that he made 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's a benchmark. I think this will be when he passes and they put director of blank in the headline. This will be one of the three movies that is guaranteed to be in every single mention. And I think that's a testament to the work he put into it, the ample opportunities he could have said, you know what, I give up, or I've done all I can, find someone else to close the deal. No, he stuck to it. And that's why I get so mad when I see him take projects that I feel are beneath him. Right, Flyer One, among other things. So I'll go 9 as well.
9 on 10 from Matt. You know, the three of us have come on these podcasts and we have discussed many times, many projects, movies that were made under duress that didn't come out that well. This movie is proof that you can make a movie under duress and still have it be the result of brilliance. And yes, I will call this movie brilliant. I think everything about this movie that didn't work ended up working for it in the end. This is a lot like how I approached the first Star Wars review, where I talked about how George Lucas had to go through everything he had to go through to get that movie made. It's the same here. These are two of the most powerful filmmakers of the last 40 years, 50 years. And when you persevere like Spielberg did here, you have people like Guillermo del Toro, like Steven Soderbergh, like J.J. Abrams, these people that come out and say, this is the movie that inspired me to become a filmmaker. And all of those people are on that documentary that me and Adam have talked about. I don't think it's any secret that I'm going to go with the amount of times that Matt has seen this. I'll go with a perfect 10 on this. I just think when you make a movie like this, there's a reason why it holds up for 50 years. And look, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is a great movie. Don't get me wrong. But in the end, this is the movie that perseveres because of the career it created and because of the legacy that it's led. We'll talk about the three sequels, but for now, I think this is a perfect movie. This is a perfect 10 on 10 with me. I could not believe how immersed I was when Chrissy was being pulled under that water. I could not believe how immersed I was when Alex Kittner was being bitten off his raft. And I couldn't believe how immersed I was. I rewound the scene of Brody on that mast shooting that shark like 2 or 3 times. I love it so much, mostly because of Williams' music as well. A triumphant movie, a triumphant achievement by all involved. 10 on 10. I can guarantee next week will not be a 10 on 10. We're going to talk about Jaws 2 next week. Adam, have you seen Jaws 2, sir?
No. There's not been a sequel of these that I've seen.
You haven't seen one sequel?
I've not seen one sequel.
Wow.
One of them I didn't know existed. One of them I know the trailer because it reminds me of a theme park close by. That's it. But I've never seen a sequel to Jaws.
Holy shit, Matt. Are the next few podcasts going to be interesting? Matt, what are you expecting when we talk about Jaws 2 next week, sir?
I've only seen it one time.
Wow.
So I don't have much. I've only seen all the sequels once. So I've seen them twice as many times as Adam has seen them. And it still doesn't amount to that many. So we'll see.
Wow. Well, Jaws 2 was one I used to watch a lot as a kid as well. Not as much as the one we'll talk about in a couple of weeks, but 2 was a big staple of mine. And Carl Gottlieb will be back next week writing that script. And, well, Spielberg will not be. But until next week when we talk Jaws 2, boys, podcast, as you know, means friendship. Thank you, guys.
But I'm telling you, and I'm telling everybody at this table, that that's a shark. And I know what a shark looks like because I've seen one up close. And you better do something about this one because I don't intend to go through that hell again.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
He did it! He did it! You see it? He did it!
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You know, you want to let that breathe for... Nothing.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
I don't have to take this abuse much longer.
It truly helps others find and discover this podcast.
Slow ahead. I can go slow ahead. Come on down and chump some of this shit.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars,
the ongoing Marvel series,
Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones,
the Exorcist films,
Avatar, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
Stop playing with yourself, Hooper!
The 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Hey! Watch how you're cutting that thing! It's critical!
The 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Excuse me, Chief.
That's great! That's just great! Now where the hell are we, huh?
Scheduling done by Matt.
Then let me go with him.
The 3 Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Daddy, look at the fish!
Holy shit!
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network. And all opinions expressed on the 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
How the hell you do that, man?
It wasn't easy, believe me.
You better watch yourself with that fancy electrical equipment down there, buddy.
Such a live wire, liable to make your hair stick up funny.
That's good, Michael.
The 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
A what?
Come and get me, you son of a bitch.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2025, and any and all sound and audio clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
Now why don't you take a long, close look at this sign? Those proportions are correct.
Love to prove that, wouldn't you? Get your name into the National Geographic.
Uh-huh.
So Brody pulls out of his... Sorry, I unplugged my mic there for a second. Brody pulls out of his... He's even told, what are you going to do, arrest the shark? What's the police going to do with the shark?
Well, it's amazing how... Very good... Oh, go ahead.
The Kubrick homage shot that we get, or sorry, the Hitchcock shot.
Yeah, you lived through COVID, everybody.
I was going to say, this is COVID all over again, man. I really got nauseous watching this.
Yeah, so yeah, I like this huge.
Matt.
Yeah, my COVID comment was my...
okay, that was your...
my insight.
Okay. We cut...
of just swell of horror as we know where the shark is going.
Matt, what do you think about this attack?
I'm good. Keep going.
Okay. However, Mike... There's only one instance where it kind of takes me out, and I'll mention it when we get there, but I'm with you guys. I think 90 to 95% it holds up okay.
Because even CGI sharks don't look right. I remember watching... What was that Blake Lively movie?
Oh, I just watched that. The Shallows?
Yeah, I think The Shallows, which is pretty good. But there are shots in that where they just use either real shark archival, like out in the wild footage that you can find on the Discovery Channel, or instances where the shark is CGI having to, like, you know, be in the same shot with her. You can clearly tell. And I'd rather this than those monstrosities in Deep Blue Sea. They look like freaking... They look like the PS1 like computer effects. It's so ridiculous.
So they start chasing the shark.
And you know good and goddamn well George Lucas is sitting on Spielberg's left like the proverbial devil going, you know, computers can really make that shark look a lot more realistic.
Have you seen Jar Jar?
There's only one instance.
Bruce is a funnier character than we've ever had before.
There's only one instance where it...
This is a different type of pacing. It's a different type of... I don't want to say acting, but the camaraderie here is way different than the other stuff. But it is great.
Guys, I got to use the restroom. I'll be right back.
I'm going to do the same. Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Alex's mother, Mrs. Kinnear, she's Kittner. Great and brings that heart. Kittner, she's great.